This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is January 16th, 2020. It's my birthday.
Happy birthday.
34 years young. And this is episode 172.
I'm Scott Glennebaum.
I'm Ian Bushfield, and today we're joined by
Kevin Milligan.
Welcome. We're going to talk to you about taxes. Taxes, taxes, taxes.
I'm here to talk about taxes. I'm happy to do so.
The six or seven people who responded to our listener survey saying we don't talk about tax policy enough are going to be super happy.
Well, then we're going to talk about Andrew Weaver's party change, quit, and how the Supreme Court of Canada smacked down BC yet again, and a little bit more. But first, we have to thank those who helped make the show possible. We're down a contributor this week to 82. We lost someone since last week, which is unfortunate. It's my birthday. Please make my wish come true. Go to patreon.com/politicoast. I think I still have Christmas songs in my head. Or just send birthday wishes to me on Twitter at PoliticoastPod. Or I guess I'm at iBushfield, but the pod needs more love. We're also in partnership, as always, with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free 2-week trial of the newsletter, go to that new website, politicstoday.news/free-trial. And a little bit of an announcement. We're going to be at Fan Expo Vancouver in February. The event goes February, I believe, 16th to 18th. I think we're going to be tentatively on the Saturday evening doing a live show. You can go there. I just saw two stars of The Office US, the guys who played Oscar and Kevin, are going to be there. Jordy LaForge, the actor behind...
LeVar Burton,
Reading Rainbow is going to be there, among others, and us somehow. So I think we're going to talk about politics of sci-fi or something like that. If you have a good guest that could join us to help make that happen, let us know, because we're trying to come up with some good ideas. Details at fanexpovancouver.com. Let's jump into our first segment, Tax Time on the 99. Kevin Milligan, economist, famous for the Twitter essays that were briefly nicknamed Tax Time on the 99. Can you walk us through why that name?
Well, I lived for a couple of years in Fairview, and I teach at UBC, so, you know, I'm a huge transit guy, so I took the 99 into work, and so it's just about a, 25-minute ride, and it's just a perfect amount of time to see the morning's news and pick a tax topic, and I would tweet it out with the hashtag Tax Time on the 99. I haven't done it recently. I've moved away from Fairview, so not riding the 99 as much, but it lives on in spirit.
It'll be tax time on what, the R? which R is the one?
Or you can do tax time on the Expo line.
Oh, that keeps the
rhyme. Yeah.
The rhyme closer than tax time on the whatever the rapid bus route on 41st is.
But we're not here to talk about rapid buses, as fun as they are. I think we want to do a bit of a backgrounder and then get into some of the contemporary debates and issues on income taxes. I did this with Alex Hemingway on Cambie Report to ask him, you know, what is a mill rate when it comes to property taxes? Because I don't think anyone really gets how property taxes work. Income taxes are a little bit more familiar, but just walk us through, Canada has a progressive income tax system. What does that mean?
So start off with income tax. Income tax is tax on your income, which is, money that you make from work or from investments. And we tax that both federally and provincially, and we tax that at progressive rates. So what that means is that the more you make, the more you pay. And it's not just the more you pay, but you pay a higher rate the more that you make. So on your first chunk of income, you pay a certain amount, and then that rate goes up as you earn more and more. So that's where the word progressive comes from, the idea being that those who make more money are able to contribute a bit more to the pot than those who are struggling.
And that's done in what's known as a marginal tax rate, right? So it's not just, oh, you made $100,000 this year, you're paying all of it at that rate, right?
That's right. So importantly, we have tax brackets, the way we do it in Canada, such that in these different brackets, you pay different rates of tax. So Federally, for example, the first $45,000 or so is taxed at 15%, and then there's another chunk that's taxed at 20.5%, and then another chunk and another chunk up to the top tax bracket, which hits in at about $212,000 or so, where you pay 33%. But as Scott said, that's only 33% for every dollar on top of $212,000 or wherever that threshold is. Now, that's federal. There's also provincial taxes on top of that, such that in BC, our top income tax rate for those who are making, you know, over $200,000 is just a hair under 50%.
And how does BC compare nationally on the income tax rate?
So for most people, the income taxes in BC are lower than anywhere else. Where we fall into second place a bit is relative to Alberta. For higher earners, you pay a bit more here than you do in Alberta. But we have very low income tax rates, not very low, but a bit lower than other parts of the country. Why is that the case? Part of it is that we have the carbon tax that explicitly added to or took away from personal tax revenues, and other choices that we've made to raise revenues in other ways. But in the BC provincial tax rates for income taxes are lower than other places.
So why have income taxes? Like in old-timey days, when Canada was just getting started, we got most of our revenue from tariffs, didn't we?
That's right. When you look at the history of tax revenue in Canada, we saw income taxes first coming in just during the First World War. And it was thought of as a temporary measure. And here we are 100 years later, and it's still there.
The number of temporary tax measures that become permanent.
Yeah, there are libertarians who are still salty about that.
Yeah, so be wary of the word temporary, I think, is a good lesson. Lots of theories about why income tax has grown. One part of it is the ease of collecting it with the rise of better administrative systems and technology and computers and deducting income tax off your paycheck. So we call that deductions at source. That just makes it a lot easier to actually collect the tax revenue than it would be if you're trying to, you know, knock on your doors like Zacchaeus in the Bible, going door to door and say, pay some taxes to the Romans or whatever he was doing. You know, that's a harder thing than getting it taken off your paycheck and you don't even see it in the first place. So, you know, that's kind of the very long history of income taxes and why we might do it as we do. But now in, you know, 2020 in Canada, about half of federal government revenue is income taxes. And at provincial level, it's a bit lower, such that of total revenue by governments at all levels in Canada, about 40% comes from personal income taxes. So it's really the workhorse. People compare it to, you know, the GST or other kinds of sources, and the personal income tax raises way, way more than those other sources.
And so from the economist's point of view, how does it compare? Because there are advantages and disadvantages to every tax. Some incentivize certain behavior or de-incentivize. Like some people worry too high income taxes will cause people to stop working because the government will just take the money anyway.
Yeah, the traditional economist argument is favoring consumption taxes like the value-added tax, or as we have the sales tax here in BC, but liking sales taxes and consumption taxes better than income taxes. And the reason for the standard economist argument there is that you're worried about the tax on the capital income part. So it's not so much the work income, it's the capital income. We're worried that that will affect how much people save, and that's bad for the economy if we have a disincentive to save. Now, I'm actually, breaking apart from the Economist Party on this, and I just don't think that's a very relevant argument in 2020. If you look around, interest rates are like 1.whatever%. And so you think about the wedge that tax puts in there on people's returns, it's actually not that big. It's really hard to have an economic model that suggests that when interest rates are 1%, that this tax of that return is a really big deal. That's point one. And point two is because of things like TFSAs and RRSPs and RESPs, there are actually very few households who pay tax on their capital income. Some very high income households do, but maybe that's what we want. So actually that whole, oh no, we're going to distort savings decisions if we have an income tax instead of consumption tax, I'm less persuaded by it than most economists, perhaps. So that just goes to say that the income tax does have a big role to play. And why would we want to have it then? So the traditional argument against it is that, like you said, the work disincentives and the savings disincentives. My argument in favor of it is that this is actually the one place in our tax system where we can push the overall revenues of the government to be more progressive. When you look at sales taxes or other kinds of taxes, it's harder to see that they are strongly progressive. That taxes, by progressive, I mean that it taxes well-off people more than people who are struggling. So with the income tax, the role I see for it is that it really pulls the system towards being a bit more progressive. And that's the major progressive thrust that we have in our government revenues. So if you were to get rid of that and just do stuff through the GST, you would leave a lot of high earners paying quite a lot less tax. And I just don't think that's fair.
That does get into the political argument, but that's fine.
Well, speaking of politics, a bunch of tax changes were promised in this past election. Can you walk us through what the current government's wanting to do with tax policy?
Yeah, let's start with the Liberals since they, quote unquote, won.
They formed government. We say that.
They get to do what they wanted.
Yes. Well
assuming the votes are there from the other parties.
Yes. Assuming all that. Their proposal is to lower or increase the basic personal amount, which is an exemption that we get from paying taxes for those at the bottom. So right now, there's an exemption of the first, I should have the number in front of me, but I don't, in the neighborhood of $12,000. First $12,000, you get a credit that offsets your taxes for the first $12,000. The proposal is to move that up to $15,000 by 2023-24. So it would be going up a bit every year anyway because of inflation adjustments. We're going to accelerate that such that it gets to $15,000 within a couple of years. So that's what the Liberals offered.
And there's a clawback higher incomes than that.
That's right. And so there's an extra twist, Scott mentioned, is that for people who are in the top two tax brackets, we're going to see that phased out. So they don't get any benefit of this. They're going to get their supplement to the personal amount is going to be phased out with income, such that if you're in the top 1%, you're not going to get any of this tax cut. So that's what the Liberals offered. The other thing on offer of the two biggest parties was from the Conservatives, which was to take the tax rate on the bottom tax bracket. I mentioned a few minutes ago that tax rate is currently 15%, and they proposed to knock, I think it was 1.25% off that, to move it down to 13.75%. Mm-hmm. From 15%?
Something like that.
Yeah, it was in that. Can't remember. I think it was 1.25%, not 1.5%. And to do that a bit over time. When you looked at this, the impact of this, and you look at a graph of the impact by income group, there wasn't an awful lot of difference. It was kind of close-ish, except when you got to the high earners, mm-hmm. where that one explicitly was not phased out for the high earners. So if you're in the top 1%, you would have benefited from that equally if you're a high earner versus a middle earner. For either of these tax cuts, important to note that they would have very little impact on those in, say, the bottom one-third of incomes. And it's important to understand why. And the reason why is that one-third of tax filers actually don't pay income taxes.
Right.
They don't have income that's bigger than, say, that basic personal amount. If you're only making $10,000 and you have a basic personal amount of $12,000, you're not paying any taxes. Any income taxes. And so for that kind of person, if you change a rate, you change a credit, you change anything, it doesn't matter because they're paying zero before, they're paying zero after. And that's one third of tax filers. That's not small. Who are those people? They are sometimes students or young people. They can be stay-at-home spouses if there's a one-earner family. There are some seniors who maybe only have income from a small source. But very often that's the case where it's a couple where one earner might be very low earner, the other one earns a lot, which makes these kinds of comparisons complicated because whether you use the family income or the individual income, it makes a different thing because if you are someone who has very low income yourself, but you live in a household with someone who's very high income, are you low income, right, or are you high income? That's, we can go around the block on that, but that's an important element of our tax system, is that one third of individual tax filers don't pay taxes. So that whether you, whatever kind of tax cut, the conservative or the liberal one, was not going to hit the people at the bottom.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean necessarily you don't want to do these tax changes. It just means that if your focus is on poverty and on helping people at the bottom who are struggling, income tax rates and brackets are not ever going to get you there.
Well, to their credit, I think both the conservatives and liberals pitched it as a middle class tax cut.
Yeah. And so that, I think, was a fair way to characterize it. For the conservative one, you had to be in the middle the bottom tax bracket. So once you were starting to earn more than the basic personal amount, you started to get this tax cut. And for the liberals, it just meant that, everyone who paid any taxes gets a little bit more of a tax break. So it did really affect those who were in the middle and at the higher end, didn't affect those at the bottom.
Do you remember from the numbers, and if you don't have them, that's fine, what the cost of the two cuts would have been comparatively? Because when we talk about tax cuts, we're talking about lost revenue.
Yeah, when you looked at, when you get out to 2023-24, right, which was kind of the end of the four-year budget window that parties were using during the campaign, it was in the neighborhood of $5.5 billion, $6 billion for each of them. And, it differed by $100 million or $200 million. Sure. When you're talking 4 years from now,
yeah,
it's a bit of, fuzziness about exactly how much it was. But it was a very similar magnitude. And it is worth asking whether, when you are in a deficit situation, whether the best thing we can do is to, stack up a bit more debt to pay for a middle-class tax cut. I'm not one who's terribly concerned about the deficit where it stands now, but you do want to ask a question of, what you're doing with the money, if you're investing in transit, if you're investing in other things that might pay off in the future. That's one thing. If it's a little bit of dessert, a little middle class tax cut, maybe that's not the easiest thing to make the case for. But we'll let the finance minister try to make the case for it, not me.
Well, one thing that a lot of finance ministers have made the case for is tax credits, and there are a lot of them. Can you kind of walk us through what a tax credit is and the difference between a refundable and non-refundable one?
So a tax credit, what it does is it reduces the taxes that you pay. So if you make $50,000 a year and we compare that to the tax rate schedule and we decide that, okay, you're going to owe $15,000 of income taxes, that's the starting place. From there, before we actually have to cut a check to the government, we get some credits. Now, some of those credits are for things like the basic personal amount, as I mentioned. There's credits for many other things that you might do, things like charitable donations. In addition to that, there are also credits for things like, or there have been in recent years, children's fitness and public transit tax credit and volunteer firefighters tax credit. And these things have multiplied. I should note that all three major parties, I'm not quite sure if the Greens have gone this way, but Liberals, NDP, and Conservatives have all put these kinds of tax credits in their election platforms.
I'm sure there's a solar panel tax credit.
That would not surprise
electric
me.
Car charging port.
Yeah. So a good thing about these, to make the case for them, is that you might want to do this if you want to encourage some behavior. So encourage solar panels or encourage charitable donations. This is one way you can do it because you provide a financial incentive to do so. But an important point about that, as you mentioned, Scott, was whether it's refundable or non-refundable. So a tax credit means that, if you have $15,000 of taxes owing and you have $1,000 of tax credits, you actually don't have to pay $14,000. Mm-hmm. So it reduces your taxes owing. So if you have a big charitable donation, you get a tax credit, it lowers the taxes that you pay. Except, what if you are that person who is maybe not making $50,000, but making $15,000, mm-hmm, such that you're actually not paying federal taxes to start with? If I then give you a tax credit, it does nothing for you because you can't go lower than zero if the tax credit is just going to wash out your tax liability. Now, that's a non-refundable tax credit, to get deep in the weeds, as you guys, I know, want to do. There's refundable tax credits, which means that even if it takes you below zero, you're still going to get that money back. So if, in other words, if your tax liability was, $500 and you had $1,000 of credits, you actually get a $500 check back from the government. And so some of the tax credits that we've talked about, the, you know, whether it's the children's fitness or the volunteer firefighters ones, those ones were non-refundable tax credits. There are some that are refundable. And that's always a question that's asked. When you see, you know, a politician with his election platform saying, vote for me because we have this new tax credit, it's always a good question to ask whether it's going to be refundable or not, because remember, one third of tax filers don't pay any income taxes. So they are never going to see the benefit of a non-refundable tax credit. And that's a really fundamental thing to understand, which gets back to why you would not want to have these things, which is if you're going to be handing out, you know, stuff for, say, children's fitness or stuff for public transit, really the people who are struggling most with those expenses are people in the bottom one third. The people who are struggling with not enough income, and they're exactly the ones who don't see any benefit from a non-refundable tax credit because they're not paying taxes to start with. The other reason why economists don't tend to like these is just the complexity and the confusion and all of the forms you have to fill in order to be eligible for them. And we know from evidence that these kind of tax credits are taken up more by those who have like a fancy accountant or a taxpayer. You know, that accountant, she knows how to fill in all the forms and how to get that done for you. And so that's an advantage to high earners that's not there for medium and low earners. But not only that, when you have all of these tax credits and confusion added to the tax system, it kind of obscures what's going on with the tax system. And people, you know, economists pay a lot of attention to those tax rates and the tax brackets and making sure that we get them set to optimize the economy. But if we lard onto that a bunch of other tax credits that are phasing out and phasing in, you know, no one knows what's going on. And so then those kind of signals that we're trying to provide with the tax system get obscured because there's just noise going in all directions.
It's interesting about that point. My work with the Humanist Association, I've tried to look at some of the where the charitable tax credits are go because I'm interested in like the religious specific. And you don't know, we don't know basically for the last year until we've done the books like 2 years later, even what the cost of charitable tax credits were. And then just the way they're filed, we also don't know who they're going to because it's also claimed by the individual rather than the charity. So there's just a lot of vagueness in there. And then you add into there what I think it was the first time super credit that the Harper government introduced that just really blows up any attempt to try to figure out how much charities cost in Canada.
Yeah, so these things are, you know, the charitable sector cares a lot about the charitable donation credit. There are a lot of these credits. You could imagine a tax reform that tried to clean some of these up and consolidate them and then use that money to lower tax rates, to provide you know, a bigger credit to people at the bottom, to do something with the tax system to clean it up, to make it simpler. The challenge is anytime you would try to address one of those measures, there's going to be an industry association. There's going to be a group of concerned citizens who are going to lobby to keep things the way they are. And that kind of concentration of political interest makes it really hard to do. It takes a government with a lot of, you know, wind in their sails to head into tax reform and take on all of those people who really want to fight to defend their particular little tax credit. You know, there's lots of them, and each one of them on their own can kind of sound reasonable sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's an adoption tax credit. People who are adopting kids, they get a bit of extra money. That sounds good, right? Adopting sounds like a good thing we want to encourage in our society. But the thing is, every single one of those tax credits has someone out there saying, yeah, this is a good thing for society. And then when you take it all together, it just makes the tax system very, very much like a ship covered in barnacles.
All the good analogies.
Yeah. Well, do we know how effective those tax credits are at changing behavior? I mean, we mentioned earlier that a lot of people don't really take advantage of it, but there's going to be an information problem. And then even if someone knows, do we know how effective it is at change in the behavior that some of these are trying to incentivize?
That's one thing that a lot of economists like to do, is to try to figure out whether these tax prices and these tax credits and rates have any impact on behavior. And the answer is it really depends which one you're talking about. For example, the public transit tax credit, there are at least three studies I'm aware of that found that almost no impact at all. And the reason is it's some tax credit you get back at the end of the year in your taxes. It doesn't affect whether you know, putting down for a monthly pass or not. It just, you know, people are going to do that or not based on some tax credit they get 12 months later. It's, on the other hand, charitable donations, is somewhere where there is actually really strong evidence that there is some sensitivity to the credit rate. Similarly, with RRSPs, there's some evidence that suggests that, you know, when taxes are higher, people are more willing to put money into their RRSP. But both of those are things that, as we know, kind of happen a lot around tax time. Mm-hmm. And so people are, taxes are on their mind, like, oh, gee, I think my taxes are too high this year. Maybe I'm going to put more on my RRSP or give some more to a charity. So kind of part of it comes down to when people are making decisions, how they're making a decision, how big the credit rate is, how big the impact is. You can't generalize that they're all bad or they're all ineffective. They're all very effective. It does depend case to case.
I imagine the political tax credits that give you like 75% off on the first 400 encourage a lot of people to give, you know, up to 400 who might otherwise not.
I definitely encourage a lot of emails from political parties at the end of the year.
Yeah, well, I mean, that certainly provides an incentive for political parties to let you know that there's a 75% tax credit. I actually don't get these emails, but I'm sure these emails that you guys are getting are saying, you know, you're getting a big tax credit. They remind you of that, which is precisely an example of what I said, that there's always an interest there. Mm-hmm. If you try to get rid of that 75% tax credit, political parties would be very upset. They would make arguments that this is how we fund democracy, and democracy might be expensive, but we ought to do it. So every one of these things, political donation tax credits, adoption tax credits, someone's there to argue for them, and they might have a strong argument these things are good. But when you take it together, it ends up a system that is very complex for people to navigate.
So a system that I experienced firsthand, because I lived there for 2 years and paid in it, was the English system, the British system, where I didn't have to file taxes for 2 years. It was amazing. They have a pay-as-you-go system because it turns out the government actually knows how much I'm making and knows how much I should be paying. And so they have all the info they need to fill in the forms. So they just do it for you. And if they get it wrong, you let them know. It's different if you're self-employed. Why don't we have that here? is my question.
When we think about the information that the Canada Revenue Agency has, they do have, you know, they get a copy of our T4s, right? It's not just it comes to us, it goes to the government as well. And all of those T5s and T3s, if you are getting investment income, you know, those all come to you, they go to the government. So as you say, there is a possibility of having pre-filled tax forms that, as opposed to starting with a blank sheet, they send you your tax form already filled in for you. So I'm not familiar with how they do it in the UK, but it sounds like of that kind, where it's like, we filled it in, let us know if it's wrong, and you can file an amendment or something. As I understand, there is a pilot program to do this in Canada. I haven't looked deeply into this. When I have asked about this before, I do recall that there was some reason why we don't do it in Canada that made some administrative sense. It's Canada, so maybe it was a federal, provincial thing. That's always the answer to
blame the other government.
Yeah. There's some coordination between governments issue, but it seems like whatever that administrative issue is, there's certainly a big gain to in simplicity and in taxpayer burden to have this kind of pre-filled tax form. And as you mentioned, the government has most of this information, and what they don't have, you can fill in on your own.
I think England doesn't have as many tax credits as well, so that makes it a lot simpler too.
Yeah, so they're not going to know, you know, your charitable donations or your public transit or a bunch of other stuff.
How many times you went to the dentist and all that.
Yeah. So maybe that is a difference there. But as a starting place, it would be nice to have that thing half filled in when you start. I'd be a happy guy.
As you mentioned it, I remember that being an option that I could click last year, and it actually did pull in 2/3.
Oh,
what was nice in England is you didn't even hit submit. It was just done.
It was there. So it was the default option.
They just mailed it to you after, and it was like, here's what we filed for you.
Well, tax policy is not just of interest in Canada. Sure, we've all been somewhat following the U.S. primary, and there's a few things that have come up there, particularly universal basic income or negative income tax and wealth taxes. So let's jump into that. Negative income tax, they've been proposed a few times. Can you kind of walk us through those, as well as have they been tried anywhere, and what do we know about them?
So a negative income tax just means using the tax system we have, the brackets, the rates, the filing, using that infrastructure, but putting in some extra tax brackets at the bottom that are essentially negative. Now, this kind of sounds weird, but we actually already do this with the GST tax credit, with the Canada Child Benefit. These are things that are based off the income tax system, but they're refundable. As we mentioned earlier, this is essentially a system with refundable credits at the bottom. So what that means is that for low earners that are now not paying income tax, we would just start paying them. Rather than them paying zero, they would actually get more of a check. And as I said, we already do this with the GST tax credit, the Canada Child Benefit. This is a tax-based delivery system for transfers to people at the bottom. And I think that that mechanism of transferring to people at the bottom and then phasing it out with income slowly is a fantastic way to redistribute some income. However, I do not think it is a fantastic way to have as the only way we distribute income. And the reason is that that system is really kind of slow and clunky. If you are a recipient of the Canada Child Benefit or the GST tax credit, you'll know that it's based on last year's income tax filing. Mm-hmm. And so if you happen to, say, lose your job tomorrow and you had to wait around before getting unemployment insurance or social assistance, if you're really struggling, like a year and a half for your negative income tax benefit to, you know, update to your new situation, people would starve. You need something that's more fast reacting. That's where we have unemployment insurance or employment insurance. That's why we have social assistance, is that they can react to, you know, changes in your situation more quickly. Or think of, you know, a person in a family that's breaking down and maybe there's spousal abuse or some kind of situation like that where someone just wants out. And it's like, okay, they get mm-hmm. out. Right now, that person can apply for social assistance and other kinds of things. If we got rid of all those other forms of income support and said, okay, I'm sorry you've been in a struggling family situation that you had to leave. A year and a half from now, we're going to update your, you know, negative income tax check and all will be good. That just doesn't work. So administratively, there are some problems with doing that. It's fantastic as a component, but it's not the only thing. So when I see people say we should replace all of our existing system with a negative income tax or a basic income, I don't think that's a good way to go. So there's parts of it I like, the phasing it out with income, you can really target it to people, but it can't be the only thing right. that we have.
One of the other things mentioned to try to reduce inequality, because that's what we're basically talking about with some of these tools and mechanisms, is a wealth tax. The NDP put that in their federal platform in the last election. It's a big thing on some candidates' platforms in the U.S. How does that compare to income taxes where?
So the difference with a wealth tax is it's going to tax not the income you earn during a year, but the pile of money that you have. So this is your savings, your investments. So your stocks, your bonds, perhaps your real estate. All that's going to be put in the pot, and we're going to call that your wealth. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren is going to give you a break in the first $50 million, and then, as she says, 2 cents per dollar on top of that. So a 2% wealth tax over top of $50 million. That was the Elizabeth Warren plan in the U.S. The NDP this election had a plan or a proposal for a 1% tax with an exemption that was not $50 million. It was 10 to...
It was smaller.
Much smaller. but it was of the same
But it was
flavor.
In Canadian dollars.
It was Canadian dollars, yeah. So the argument in favor of this is that there is a... some people at the very, very high ends of the wealth distribution have a lot of wealth, and we could, Elizabeth Warren argues that we could fund a lot of public programs with this 2% wealth tax. And it is true in the U.S. there's a lot of people with a lot of wealth, and there's been some debate about the revenue you might get from it. And, even at the low end of the revenue estimates, there'll still be a lot of money there. In Canada, we don't have as many Bill Gates and Warren Buffetts as they have in the U.S. So it's not clear the revenue would be, you know, in the same kind of range you'd see in the U.S. So that's one aspect of it. So people want to do it because I think they could get revenue for public programs and maybe push back a bit against the super wealth concentration at the very top. Against that, a couple arguments against it. And one argument you'll hear that tax experts will say, it's really hard to measure wealth because unlike income taxes, where there's T4 slips going to the government every year, with wealth, it's kind of like you have to self-report a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I have a painting on the wall. It's worth $10 million. I have, this very nice furniture. It's worth $100,000. You have to self-report a lot of this stuff. It's illiquid. There's not a market for it. And so you could imagine people might not report it. Furthermore, You could walk across the border, put it in the Virgin Islands, and maybe that doesn't get seen by the government as well. So there's these avoidance aspects of it. Now, that, I think, is actually really important. Countries that have had wealth taxes have found that is actually something that matters. But I have learned as a tax policy guy that that is not the first argument you want to make, that great idea, seems like it would be hard, so you can't do it. People don't like being told they can't do something, A. And B, a good answer is, well, we'll just work hard to make sure we can get it done. We'll just put our elbows to the grindstone. Or
hire more accountants.
Hire more accountants. We'll make sure we do it well. And that's, not a bad counterargument. So I actually like to address the fundamental part of it, which is this a good idea or not? And I actually don't like an annual wealth tax. The reason is that an annual wealth tax of, say, Elizabeth Warren's 2%, imagine your wealth is earning a return of 4% a year, okay? So you're making some investments, earning 4% on that. If you're paying income tax of 50% on that 4%, there goes 2 points of it. And then Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax is taking away the other 2 points. It actually ends up eating the income on the wealth almost entirely. And so it actually ends up being a very excessive tax, thought of in terms of the return on wealth rather than just the wealth itself. And so that's maybe not a great thing. But importantly, it taxes the same amount for everyone. If you happen to be very lucky and you get a windfall investment that returns 100% in 1 year, the wealth tax just gets 2% of that.
Mm.
In contrast, if you have an income tax that taxes capital gains, that gain that you saw, that 100% gain, that's going to be taxable.
Right.
Right? And so it's going to tax people who have big gains, whereas the annual wealth tax does not. And so it actually is more effective, in, I would argue, in capturing big windfall gains, which is something that I think maybe ought to be subject to tax more than the annual return to wealth. Now, this is not to say we maybe shouldn't tax wealth. If we're going to do it, my argument would be to do it through estate taxation, end-of-life taxes. They have an estate tax in the U.S. We do not in Canada. There are some small probate fees in some provinces, but we do not have an estate tax in Canada. That would be, to my mind, a better way to do it, because then you would capture these big windfall gains that you don't with an annual wealth tax.
Well, it just feels like the key way to end hegemonic dynasties of families, where it's just like so-and-so's son's daughter still has as much money because they just put it all in their will.
You're going to do that with an estate tax. The 2% wealth tax won't actually knock that back an awful lot. So if your goal is to get rid of those hegemonic families, the estate tax is a better tool to get there. So, perhaps it's a bit too much subtlety for politics and political discussion of an annual wealth tax versus an estate tax. But I actually think the economics is better for an estate tax than an annual wealth tax. But then on the practical nature of it, of whether you can actually collect this and write down tax law that defines what's in and what's out, that gets very complicated with an annual wealth tax. Just as one final point on that, remember small business corporations, if you exempt working capital in small business corporations, guess what? Everyone who has wealth will start up a small business corporation and park the money in there. So that gets into that whole debate we had in 2017 about small businesses and whether they're in or out of, how we tax them. Mm-hmm. And you thought that was a harsh debate. Just wait until we start applying wealth taxes or not applying wealth taxes to those pots of money. So it gets really complicated to define what's in and what's out. When you start to do that, you help accountants a lot, and maybe you don't help tax revenues as much.
Well, let's pivot to close the segment with a few questions that came from our patrons, one of which just plays perfectly off this theme, which is tax avoidance came up. What Adria really wanted to know is, is tax avoidance a big issue in Canada? Are there obvious loopholes that should just be closed tomorrow?
I don't have any top five list, I suppose I should, of tax loopholes I'd like to close, but there are, it is a very important issue. And the reason to me it's important is thinking about something that tax scholars call tax morale, which essentially gets into how happy are you to pay taxes. And
I'm guessing this ranges from not yeah. very happy at all to extremely unhappy.
Yeah, yeah. There's a certain range.
I think
the
height is begrudgingly.
But part of what goes into it is whether you think that everyone else is kicking in too. Mm. And if people start to get the idea that there's a separate tax system for the rich than everyone else, that makes them think that the system is rigged against them. That's the kind of language we heard both from Bernie Sanders and from Donald Trump in 2016. And it's very corrosive to tax morale and to people thinking like that we are all in this together. And when there's a shock to the economy and a shock to society, that we are going to face those challenges together, that people at the high end are going to pay their share, people at the low end are going to contribute what they can. And that's the fundamental sense that I think is really important to keep, tax morale sufficiently high, is that people know that the high earners are paying their fair share as well, and that there's not ways that they can, you know, game the system to get out of it. So that's why I think it's really important that the federal government has put over its last few budgets $1 billion more into the CRA, specifically tasked with pushing back on things like the Panama Papers and the international high wealth transactions that people try to use to hide their money from the tax man. Put money in for that and for auditing big dollar returns to try to enforce the tax laws that exist. And so that's where a good starting place is, beyond thinking about closing some loopholes, at least enforce well the ones that are there. There are certainly some proposals out there of trying to, they tend to get very technical.
Right.
Because, you know, that's the game, right? If when you're a high income person with $100 million sitting around, you can afford really good tax advice. And so they're going to be right into the weeds of what's deductible here and how I get a double loop deduction there.
There's obviously not a like loophole line where you just write a number in and just like don't have to pay that much.
To me, one
really
of the
easy to catch that.
One of the biggest low hanging fruits 4 years ago, if you'd asked me that question, was the Small Business Corporation, which was clearly a place where a lot of people who, you know, were not a mom and pop general store, but just consultants and doctors and lawyers were putting money into these corporations and having them taxed in a very generous way. And the government has pushed back on that a bit. I think that's a good thing. But to give your listeners one thing to grab onto that you might learn about by reading up a bit is something called the lifetime capital gains exemption. So if you have small business corporation shares, you can have an exemption of over $800,000 once in your lifetime for the sale of those shares. You don't pay capital gains taxes on them. There's an awful lot of tax planning that goes around that exemption. People don't know about it, but that was actually only $500,000 at the beginning of Stephen Harper's first term. By the time he finished, it was over $800,000. They put that up, and that's the kind of thing that slipped in the budget. Most people don't notice, but I can tell you, every accountant and tax lawyer knew all about that, and they were planning how they're going to deal with their small business clients to set up their structures such that they could exploit that lifetime capital gains exemption. So if you want to know where we might go and focus on trying to limit the possibilities for tax avoidance for high earners, that's one thing that I might put on the list.
All right. Nick wants to know about the possibility of setting up a federal or provincial property tax and kind of having a more global mill rate than what we see where it varies city by city, and whether or not that would kind of help kind of redistribute the property wealth a little more.
The Constitution allows the federal government to raise revenue through whatever channel it wants, whatever means it wants. So there's no barrier constitutionally to the federal government going into property taxes. However, if the federal government went strongly there, they would be most likely get some phone calls from provincial finance ministers saying, hey, what are you doing coming into this? We're there. They kind of, it's kind of like stealing their parking spot. You're allowed to take that parking spot, but it's kind of like we've been parking there. That's our place. We kind of like to get the revenue from that. So that's kind of an informal argument why the federal government isn't getting there. It's not an argument, a very strong argument against it. Federal government could go there. Why would you want to do it? Well, you know, land, they're not making much more of it. So that what that means is if you increase the taxes on land, there's not really an efficiency cost there in that the land doesn't pick up and move away. The land doesn't work less. The land doesn't, you know, produce less return. The land is just land. And so if you tax it high, you tax it low, it's still just land. So for an economist, that's a very, very efficient thing to tax because there's no changes in behavior and there's no distortions that arise from that. So that sounds fantastic. You can do that. As we know in Vancouver, there's a lot of money there. And if you were to increase that, maybe we could lower the GST or lower the personal taxes or something else. This is sounding good. You're selling me on this, maybe. But the downside of this is when you increase property taxes, the people who bought property yesterday just ended up with the short end of the stick because the price you're willing to pay for property is going to depend a bit on what the property taxes are. So if you tell me there's a huge property tax, I'm not going to pay as much for your property. And so you're going to impose a huge capital loss on the people who bought yesterday, and they're not going to be happy. And since we're in a place with what proportion of families or voters hold property, it's most likely over 50%, you're going to be disappointing an awful lot of people if you were to increase property taxes on them. Now, a way to get around that is to have like the, what we call it, the school tax. This is the debate from 2 years ago.
Yeah.
There was an exemption of $3 million on that. So that's a way you could get around that. Just tax the super high properties. And I don't have a great argument against that. So it sounds like a good thing to me. We should do more of it. How's that?
I think the NDP proposed a federal speculation tax in the last election, but I don't think anyone has looked at this. Good idea. I guess it's a good idea. But like you point out, politically, might be really tough.
Yeah, and I mean, it'd just be a question of trying to focus it so you have an exemption that is high enough that people think like it's not going to hit them for the median voter anyway.
Yeah, just I think the ratio or rate of homeownership, something like 65%
nationwide,
plus or minus about 5% on that.
Sounds about right.
Nationwide.
Yeah.
But Vancouver, it's about
lower,
a little under half of households.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you can design it like with the school tax increase to have a big exemption such that only the people at the very top are hit. And that seems like a good revenue base, I think, is actually underused in Canada because that wealth is there and we could use it for some public purposes that, you know, rather than sitting empty and creating blight in our high income neighborhoods.
Plus, it will be a huge boost to the red sign making industry.
Yes, those red signs in the west side. There's still a few of them up, and I laugh every time I see it.
So the last question comes from Sancho, who asks another political question, which probably has some economic sides, but I think this is more a political one. Why has BC kept MSP for so long rather than just roll it into taxes? And who benefited from either just having a flat rate premium, which we had, or under the current system, the employer health tax?
Right, for the MSP premiums that we used to pay, it was a head tax. It was a flat amount for everyone. Everyone paid the exact same amount. There was an exemption for people. Used to be under 20,000, then it was moved up a bit higher.
You had to go and apply for it. It wasn't
You had to apply for it. And take up rate for the exemption was like only 2/3 or so. So many people who were eligible for the exemption. I still ended up paying MSP.
I remember getting the exemption, but I'd gotten like a series of overdue notices for my MSP. And I was just like, well, I'm not paying this because I get the exemption. And it turns out they don't charge interest if you're overdue on MSP.
Oh, hey, there you go. Well, now that it's gone, it doesn't matter. But it's still interesting to know. So it seems, you know, ostensibly that went to pay for health, but it just went into general revenues. I didn't see any strong argument for that tax. We should be putting, you know, the burden on people who can most afford to bear the burden, which is not people at the bottom, which it was actually a very heavy tax for people at the bottom. So I was happy to see that the government was trying to address this. The challenge, though, came from the way that ended up working, which was some employers paid it on behalf of their employees. Other employers, you paid it yourself. It happens to be the case at UBC. I actually do pay it. It's not paid by UBC. Hmm. Many public sector employers is paid by, you know, the union negotiates this with their employer. And I think someone told me at SFU, it was paid by the employer. So even within the higher education sector, it varies around. But think what happens then if you swap that out with a, you know, the employer health tax that's now there or some other kind of tax. For me, I'm sitting there at UBC. I was paying this thing before. It was right on my monthly pay stub. Now it's not there. I feel fantastic. Now UBC is all of a sudden getting the full burden. Now at SFU, on the other hand, if they were paying it on behalf of their employees before, it's really no different. They're paying an employer health tax now. They're paying the MSP on behalf of their employees before. It's the exact same thing. And so is that difference across different employers that made it really challenging? Because half the employers, the ones who were, you know, paying already on behalf of their employees, they didn't care. Where the other employers are really mad because they're like, this is a new tax for them to pay. And so I think undoing that part of it was the trickiest part. If they had replaced it with like an increase in income taxes or something, again, it would have been the reverse. Me, I was already paying the MSP on my pay stub. If I saw my income taxes go up a bit, my MSP go down, I didn't care. But the guy at SFU who was not paying MSP before, all of a sudden sees an income tax increase, he's grumpy. So that I think was the biggest problem with undoing it, was that difference across different workplaces. And the way that they did it is they said, we're going to do this employer side health tax. You don't see it on your pay stub anymore. And we're going to do some transition funding and ease it in. But essentially, employers are taking the hit.
Yeah, they did bring in Lindsay Tedds in the MSP task force to look at this. And famously, you know, they got halfway through and just decided which way they were going anyway. But it sounded like the task force was going more towards the let's have a little bit here or a little bit there and kind of spread the hit out a little bit more.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that task force didn't have a full hearing for their findings. But when thinking about these kinds of, you know, employer health taxes or payroll taxes on employers or employees, it's really important to note that whatever they are in Canada, it's a small fraction of what it is in many other places in the world. So in Europe, for example, payroll taxes are like 20%, 25% of payroll. In the U.S., for their Social Security and Medicare taxes, it's in the double digits they pay. So there's actually almost nowhere among the high-income OECD countries where payroll taxes are lower than in Canada. So when we hear people get really upset about the increase in Canada Pension Plan payroll contributions that's gone up or this one, we should think of that in the context that Canada actually has very low payroll taxes relative to even the U.S.
Well, any concluding tax thoughts before we move along?
No.
Okay. Well, if you could tell our listeners where they can find you if they want to check out Tats Time on the 99 or so on your other work.
On Twitter, you can find me at Kevin Milligan. You can Google me up. I'm Kevin Milligan, and I teach economics at University of British Columbia.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Moving on to segment two. Andrew Lever. So this week, Andrew Weaver dropped a bit of a bombshell when he announced that in addition to stepping down as leader, he's leaving the Green Party entirely and is going to sit as an independent.
He's torn up his membership card. He's going to sit in the corner by himself and just, I don't know. No one really knows what he's going to do or why he's doing this. Apparently, though, it wasn't a bombshell because if anyone actually read McLean Kay's publication, The Orca, they would have actually known this in December when he told them, literally, that he was planning to go, the day he was no longer leader, to go nonpartisan. That he didn't join a party until he was a member of the Green Party, and he will resign his membership when he leaves as leader. And he's leaving as leader on January 20th, and that's when... Or he's already left as leader, but he's tearing up his member card on January 20th. Tough break for McLean there, though. Like, not a bad guy, but just, like, all the people who are, like...
What's happening here? And this was reported, what, back on the 20th of December, I think it was? Or December 11th. So, yeah.
It wasn't even the holidays.
Yeah, it was out there before, but December's a tough time for political reporting.
Yeah, so Weaver's justification for this is he needs to, quote, better balance work with competing health demands affecting his family. He's not eager, it sounds like, to just use this as a chance to bring down the government and get out of politics. He says, you know, I signed the confidence and supply agreement. I'm going to honor it, but I just don't like being a partisan, I guess.
Possibly. He's always had some unusual ideas when it comes to partisanship and politicians. He's been a long proponent of term limits. So like this isn't entirely out of character for him, but it's still a really weird and unprecedented thing for a politician to do.
Yeah, and especially within the Green Party where Adam Olsen, one of the other MLAs, actually did take a sort of leave of absence like this from extra responsibilities to focus on his own personal life, which all MLAs should, I think, be reasonably afforded that opportunity. If stuff comes up, you should be able to focus on it. I think it's one of the toughest things probably for all these MLAs in such a tight, balanced power situation where they all need to show up all the time is, you know, what if you need sick leave or parental leave, or you need to go to a funeral. Like in the UK, there was the case of one of the Brexit votes where someone was wheeled in on a stretcher to vote. Or was this in the States? It's happened a few times.
I'm pretty sure it was a UK thing. This definitely happened in the UK. I'm not sure if it was over Brexit.
And there is a tradition in some parliaments where there's better collegiality of doing a vote-for-vote share, like, oh, one of my team is on vacation. Can one of your team sit out? Okay, and then we'll do that for you next time. I guess trust is gone. And now Weaver is bitter and wants to sit in the corner. For the Greens, though, this doesn't destroy their official party status. That was set at 2, which is a number that I think was determined by the floor of the NDP's performance historically in 2001 when there was just 2 members and they didn't get party status. So I think they were like, all right, we want party status for the Greens, but we'll set it at 2 just in case we get wiped out again. But it does actually affect how much money they'll have.
Yeah, because the funding the caucus gets is dependent on the number of members of the caucus. And this right now just slashes the caucus by a third.
And so there goes a bunch of money. That's staffers, that's research assistants, that's people that really help make them a more effective opposition. So in that way, it's kind of a middle finger to his colleagues.
It's also just, I mean, we said this at the start, a weird thing to do, but like leaving caucus is a fairly major undertaking, definitely a signal to the public. And it only really happens when there are, you know, some bitter feelings between members of caucus
or there's a
reason why someone has now become a liability and needs to be ejected from the party.
Yeah, we've had a couple independents in this legislature, most famously Daryl Plekis, who was kicked out of his party for going to become speaker. But then there was also the Liberal MLA who left and sat as an independent briefly when allegations were surrounding his spending. Once those cleared, he rejoined the party. So you don't usually just quit the party when you're bored or tired of politics. But Weaver's a little bit different of a politician, I think.
Yeah, I think this is the famous do it in politics differently that the Green Party likes to talk about so much.
And that brings me to one of the other things he told the Orca, which is really standout. I think, did you flag this?
Yeah, I post this to our patron Slack.
I'll let you read it then, because it's a glowing quote.
So Weaver says that probably the most difficult part is the level of political naivety.
That's of being a Green Party member.
Yeah, this is as leader of the Green Party. I see it all the time as I see these incredibly well-meaning Green supporters on Twitter who are, I mean, it's a lovely level of naivety. It's lovely. I mean, it's lovely in that I wish there was more of this, but it's a bit like the Christians being fed to the lions.
It's weird. You don't usually, on your way out as a political leader, like attack your base, your supporters.
Well, he clearly just does not care anymore. But it's a dynamic that happens a lot on Twitter and probably in the in-person Green Party meetings too.
It is a really bizarre comment though. And like, I get it. Like there are a lot of politically naive and optimistic people out there and bless and all of that. But I think he's trying to say it as a nice thing in some way, but it's also a bit of a, like, clearly a frustration for him because he admits to having to have what he calls, you know, going from stakeholders here to stakeholders there while trying to drive from A to B. You kind of have to take a zigzaggy route to get there. I think that's his way of justifying all the, like, compromises to the core Green values. Like, all right, we went to a electoral referendum on proportional representation. Okay, LNG is going to happen, but I'm going to stamp my feet about it. And, you know, that's off the Green message, but he's still driving towards a greener future.
Well, this
or
is...
was.
Well, the Green Party's had to, over the last couple of years, navigate from becoming basically a party that doesn't really exist in legislatures beyond maybe the occasional, like, single member caucus to a party that actually has to do the messy work of politics in a, all intents and purposes, a governing coalition and to trying to get stuff passed. And the party culture hasn't necessarily come along with that very quickly.
That's tough. I think it takes a lot of professionalization, which takes a lot of money and some time to get people trained and hired. The Greens are on the way. And I think a new leadership contest is a great chance to make sure things don't atrophy in the way that possibly the federal Greens did under Elizabeth May, where it was just kind of the same face on it for so long that it just became a brand. At least now there's some time for new blood to get injected and some new energy for the Green Party. But it still leaves everyone wondering, why? Why did he leave? And there's not really a clear answer other than just Andrew Weaver's either a different kind of politician or he wants to torpedo this government.
Or his own now former party members.
Yeah, maybe Andrew Weaver just really hates the BC Greens. It's possible. It does make me wonder what he's going to do as an independent. So he won't have to be on committees now. Will he try and ask questions in question period? Because that his role is reduced. Maybe in committees of the whole, he might try and speak up in a more independent way.
Who knows? He has his own eccentricities, so it's really hard to tell.
It's the story that kind of left everyone scratching their head all week. And this followed the previous round of speculation about whether there'd be a 2020 election with Keith Baldry writing out for Black Press a list of reasons why there won't be. Rob Shaw wrote for Vancouver Sun. The possibility there could be, and he tried to find anyone he could who would say there would be a 2020 election. And it's all kind of up in the air. You know, I still don't tend to think there will be, but
I don't think this makes it more likely because he has signed the confidence and supply agreement. If he really wanted to make things interesting, he would have just left politics altogether rather than finishing out the term. And that would have created a by-election, which the Liberals probably would have thrown a lot of resources into trying to win, both because before Andrew Weaver represented Oak Bay, Gordon Head, it was a Liberal seat. And the demographics there are fairly favorable to the Liberals.
Yeah, in the last election, about half the vote went to Weaver, and then the NDP and Liberals kind of split equally, actually, the other votes. But it's one of those places where I think the Greens are more like Liberals than the Greens are more like NDP, which isn't true everywhere, but in Oak Bay, Gordon Head is probably...
There's a lot of Green Liberal switchers there.
But I guess we'll have to see how much more politics Andrew Weaver does, because it sounds like he's very excited to go back to the University of Victoria. Moving on to quick takes, the news this morning, right after the hearing for BC's reference case at the Supreme Court of Canada, was the judges got very frustrated, so much so that BC's lead lawyer, Joe Arvey, who's highly respected, got so... to the point where he was just like, if I'm not going to win the appeal, I don't want to lose badly, is what he told the judges.
So to set the stage here, this is the lawsuit over the legislation the BC government introduced to basically try and regulate the activities around the Trans Mountain pipeline and the oil shipments through the province. And this was very explicitly a, we're trying to block the pipeline bit of legislation. That got challenged in court.
It was a reference question. They actually put the regulations to the court and said, could we do this? And the BC Court of Appeal said, no.
No. This is very clearly federal jurisdiction. And then it got appealed up to the Supreme Court, which was an automatic appeal in this case. And the Supreme Court more or less looked at it and said, no, of course not. And dismissed it from the bench in what is a very... rare move.
Yeah, in other words, rather than go and discuss all the arguments that had been presented to them, they just went, that went badly, BC. We're just going to say what the Court of Appeal said. They're fine. They got it right.
Yeah, less than a half an hour after the oral arguments ended.
Notably, the last time that I remember the Supreme Court of Canada doing this was another BC appeal where the province was fighting the Teachers Federation. And in that case, the court came back in 15 minutes and sided with the Teachers Federation and kind of shocked everyone. So
the parties that are one to one for embarrassing Supreme Court losses.
It's a provincial pastime at this point. So looks like the biggest tool in BC's toolkit is gone.
Which I think everyone expected to be the case. This was always a long shot, and it's... I think questionable whether or not it was just worth the legal expenses and trying to push this very obviously flawed case through.
Yeah, the Supreme Court seems like a bad choice at this point. But here we are. Well, next up, Global News, Sam Cooper has another, what's described as a bombshell or explosive story on money laundering in the province. He's been covering this for a while. He's had a number of really good scoops. This one notes that someone, quote, connected to an Asian organized crime was allowed by the provincial regulator to buy a casino from the BC Lottery Corporation.
A stake in a casino.
To buy a stake in a casino. It was signed off by the government employee. That employee was later hired by said casino. And then this was reported in an RCMP report that was provided to the government. And rather than do anything about this, 3 months later, the government defunded and disbanded that unit of the RCMP.
Yeah, they've taken quite a bit of criticism over the choice to disband the unit. But this just adds additional kind of sketchy context to that.
Yeah, it's we'll throw the link in the story in the show notes and you can read all about it. There's a lot of other jarring, what's called jarring allegations of victimization. Women with gambling debts in Asia being trafficked to BC and forced into sex work. Children in BC thrown in a chunk of a car, warned at gunpoint that their father owed $300,000. Scary stuff. Kind of makes us glad there's a public inquiry into all this money laundering and stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's bad. It's bad. Read the story.
And related to that, Andrew Wilkinson has come out and told the Linda Steele show that he will be working with the Attorney General's office to gather documents from, or gather cabinet documents related to the money laundering inquiry and provide them to the inquiry.
This is something the NDP has been asking for a while, partially because it's an easy way to embarrass the Liberals because they were almost never going to do it. It's every government has cabinet confidence so that they can protect their decisions. That's a good thing. But there's been enough questionable content like that story we just talked about that make you wonder what happened in the Liberal cabinet, who knew what. And Wilkinson, has, as leader, has wanted to say, no, I will not break that. And now it sounds like he's opening up a little. But they're going to internally review what they can provide confidentially to the Attorney General rather than either just give everything over, which would never happen, or have like a judge review it for what's most important. The Liberal, BC Liberal staff will carefully
first pass on it.
Do the review. So yeah, money laundering, still a very big story in this province.
And will continue to be for quite a while, I imagine. Well, jumping to the federal scene, the Conservative Party leadership race has now officially gotten underway. We talked a bit about the rules last week, and we've already had our first casualty as the
Brian Brulotte, the
person whose name I had to briefly pause to try and remember, the
Human Resources CEO.
Yeah, CEO from Ottawa. Apparently longtime Conservative Party activist, briefly threw his name in consideration, has now decided that, you know, the states are maybe a bit too rich for him and he won't be going ahead.
I guess he doesn't know 3,000 Conservative members or have $300,000 he wants to just
probably
burn.
Probably the second one.
Nevertheless, Peter McKay has officially, quote, I'm in a fairly unsurprising turn. Rona Ambrose, I saw a number of competing reports. Apparently, La Presse said she's not in, but then the National Post said undecided still. Maybe Ambrose is not in. We don't know yet.
And perhaps the most interesting development of all of this is Stephen Harper's resigned from the Conservative Fund. This is the organization that basically manages the Conservative Party's money.
And the one that seemingly torpedoed Andrew Scheer on the way out the door with the private school spending scandal.
Yeah. Now the former prime minister has resigned because he wants to take a more active role in the leadership race, specifically to try and block John Charest's bid.
This is amazing. The fact that this story is out there is just great. Like, Stephen Harper has not been in the media much in the last couple of years, and where it is, it's like, oh, he has a book and he's just doing the tour and kind of just disappearing into the background. The fact it's publicly out there that he will do stop at nothing to stop Jean Charest doesn't make me like Jean Charest anymore, but it is an amusing kind of anecdote. Like, did Charest even have that much of a chance?
It was always going to be a tough play for him to win the Conservative Party. He hasn't been super active in it for quite a while. He has a lot of baggage from his time as Quebec Premier. And in addition to that, you know, the Conservative Party's moved on quite a bit since he was a major member of it. Yeah. So it was going to be a tough play for him. But this clearly indicates there's a much more bad blood than it seemed like from the surface back when Harper and Charest were leading Canada and Quebec, respectively.
Well, in the immortal Twitter words of Michael Harris from 2015, Harper is still lurking, be vigilant. But the other person who's retiring from their organization this week is Preston Manning, who's leaving the Manning Center for Founding Democracy, or whatever the full title of the Manning Center, the conservative think tank that's been fairly active for the last number of years, networking and making sure the United Right stays mostly united. And what's notable about this is as he leaves the foundation, the center, they want to change their name.
It's a little unusual sometimes, but most interestingly, they've put out a request sheet.
They emailed their supporters saying, hey, here's a Google sheet. Please fill it out. Let us know what you think the name should be, what name it shouldn't be, and a few questions like that. And then naturally, someone puts that sheet on Twitter, so we'll throw a link in the show notes. Because, you know, if you have ideas for what Canada's leading conservative think tank should or shouldn't be named, I think they want to hear it. Even if it's, you know, Righty McRightface or some variation on that. Oh, and tweet us your funny names for the Manning Center at Politicos Pod.
Yes, do that. And that has been Politicos. Find links to everything we talked about at politicos.ca. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicos. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Shersha Potikoff. Politicos is a production of Leg and Boot Media. Thanks for listening.